From Akron, Ohio, this is episode 131 of On the Tropes, and this is episode 1 of Halloween in July.
Ooh.
On this week's episode, we are going to talk about the new smash hit horror film, Get Out, which is available for rent on...
everything.
Yeah, places where you rent things. And then, so we're going to talk about that, we're going to do a little spoiler-free discussion, then we're going to do a little... some spoilery discussion, and then we're going to talk about our favorite scenes and tropes from that movie. But first, as always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I'm joined by...
Sir.
Demo.
And Kyle.
So do you guys want to jump into it?
Yes.
Just get going?
Yeah, let's just...
So Get Out?
Let's go in.
It's awesome. I mean...
it was written in direct...
Wait, Get Out. Let's just go in.
Oh!
I did that on purpose.
I questioned that. Did you?
No.
Oh, well done.
Not even slightly.
So what is that? When you stumble upon serendipitous.
Very yes.
Good. Mm-hmm. Jordan Peele, right? So we all know Key and Peele. Love Key and Peele.
He plays Keegan-Michael Key on Key and Peele.
And we talked, we didn't get into it on our chat or anything, but we did just mention after we had seen the movie, each of us individually, and I said that I was a little, I guess, annoyed at how good this movie is for a first-time writer-director in this genre. Like, I don't know. I don't think he's directed anything. I mean, Tarantino's first movie, he calls it Guitar Chips. It's not Reservoir Dogs. It was a movie beforehand that he destroyed because it was so bad. like, and Peele comes out swinging with this. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I think one of the things that I keep thinking of is what Peele said, I guess, in an interview about how comedy and horror are really similar in that they both deal with tension and timing. And, it, you know, if you can get one of those things down, then you're good. And then I also think it's like, you know, he'd been writing it for a while. So, like, by the numbers, though, the movie cost $4.5 million to make, and it's made $250 million. It's the highest grossing film from an original screenplay, like, ever. It beat out the Blair Witch Project from... was that 99?
Mm. 99, yeah.
Woo! I can't believe so. There you go.
And it was shot in like 23 days or something.
Yeah, it was shot in
really,
like a few weeks.
Really quickly.
What? Unbelievable.
Stop telling me details about the production of this, because it just is upsetting to me.
Jealous much?
Yeah.
I'm not going to
deny it. It's amazing.
What I love to see after I watched the movie, because I didn't want anything spoiled, was...
should say, we're not going to spoil it now. If you haven't seen it, just, you know, we're going to talk spoiler-free for a little bit, but I didn't even watch a trailer for this. Did after the fact. The trailers give way too much away.
Yeah.
I saw the trailer
really early.
I felt a very, very early teaser.
It was like,
but
really, like, way before, was it even released? I don't even know. It was like a while, and then...
must have been, I want to say, like, years. Is that possible?
Years before.
I mean,
it does feel like, though, it was easily like 6 months.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
But I just love hearing how big of a horror fan Jordan Peele was. And there are a few movies that he borrows influences from making this one. And it was cool to see some nods. And
You said there are a couple Shining ones that
Yeah. I guess he's like a really big fan of The Shining. And it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense, though, because you would never think for all the comedy stuff he does on TV how into this genre, which, I mean, sort of said that they're similar, but it was really cool that he really did an amazing job first time writer and director. I know first time director, but
he wrote it. Okay.
So in his own words, it's so much of it is pacing, so much of it is reveals.
Yeah.
Another part of it, too, is from a fandom perspective, horror and comedy. Like, everyone likes a horror movie or a comedy movie, but people who get into it tend to be geeks. Like, it's something when you start to obsess about them, it tends to draw that same kind of obsessive, like, I want to know everything about every slow burn horror movie. I want to check out all the classics. I want to see how they made them tick. And, I heard him on a couple of other podcasts that weren't this one, so we're not going to even name them. In fact, I don't even know if they exist. But he was going on about taking from Rosemary's Baby, The Shining.
I was going to say, I found a lot of Rosemary's Baby influence on here. I didn't know if that was something that he was intentionally drawing.
That was another one too that they mentioned.
And then the Stepford Wives is
which I've never actually seen.
I saw it. I mean, as a kid, and I didn't see it. Since.
The Matthew Broderick one.
Can't even remember.
I don't even like. I don't get that joke, but I knew the way you delivered it. I was like, "That's got to be a joke."
No, they remade it with Matthew Broderick and I think Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, it was Nicole Kidman.
I mean, I didn't see it, so maybe not being entirely fair to it, but it was supposed to be terrible.
You're thinking of Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
I want a really hard R Inspector Gadget.
Wait, what is that movie? I can't think of it. Is it Machine Girl? There's a movie that's essentially that. It's like a splatter, splatter grindhouse flick from I want to say it's J-horror, but it's a revenge story and the woman's just like a cyborg.
I think we're thoroughly off the rails. So.
Do we want to do just the back of the box sort of what the movie is about?
Yeah. What is the back of the box? Because there's stuff pretty early on where. I don't know where the spoiler line.
You can just end it in that things turn, things happen.
Yeah.
Basically, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya.
Yeah.
Who people might know from, he's in Sicario, and he is in the second episode of Black Mirror. He's really good in.
Yeah, that's once we get into the performance.
The English accent isn't his native accent.
No, he is British.
Yeah, the American accent. Sorry.
Yeah, he's a British actor.
Yeah.
Basically, he is a young photographer, and he is dating Allison Williams, Ryan Williams' daughter.
She's in Girls.
They are going to meet her parents for the first time, and he's a little apprehensive because they're in a mixed racial relationship.
And she assures him, "Don't worry, my family is very liberal. My dad would have voted for Obama a third time if he could."
Mm-hmm. Which, man, I've used that to to describe so many people since then. guy would have voted for Obama a third time if he could.
my favorite thing, one of my favorite things about this movie is that I could totally see that montage of the dad trying to show, look how liberal I am. Mm. I've already heard this in real life. People using that same tone to talk about this movie, you've got to see Get Out. I mean, it's important, but using that, no, really, I'm a liberal tone.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
And what I think those people maybe are getting is that this movie... So last night, I watched Get Out on Friday. We're recording this on Sunday. I watched it 2 nights ago. Last night, I watched In the Heat of the Night for the first time, a movie from the 60s, which is about, overt racism in the South. And this is kind of the opposite side of the coin, where this is white, woke, liberal racism. And it's just as bad.
Easily just as bad. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm going to save a lot of it for the spoiler section.
It's easily just as bad.
And there's so many parallels to how that racism actually plays out in real life.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you say that, because what I think is funny about the movie is that that's probably a pretty large percentage of the audience who considers themselves to be, non-black, liberal, not maybe either A, not realizing that the movie is skewering them, or B, watching the movie and going, oh crap, am I this family? Is that me?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, definitely watching it. Mm-hmm. Because I identify as a liberal, and definitely it was cringy. Because in the back of my head, I'm wondering,
have I done that?
well, and also, everything's in degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is to what degree have I mirrored the actions that I'm seeing here without even realizing it?
Mm-hmm.
And trying and enforcing that to examine you is an experience you don't get from many films where it forces you to look at yourself and examine yourself.
Yeah,
so. And I think that constant examination is the... That's the thing. I mean, I don't want to get too serious. However, it's everybody has privilege, and unless you constantly call it into question, you'll never notice it. I think one thing I noticed about the movie, to touch on what you were saying, Nick, I think the movie turned, or what the most saying, the movie turned into people saying, "Well, I've seen this movie, so I'm not, I'm okay." Because when it first came out, do you guys remember the early reviews and hearing about white members of the audience walking out And
no,
like,
I never heard.
I heard like all kinds of stuff, like when it first like really got big, of like people, you know, and just reading, like people were really upset about the events of the film and different things like that. And yet, as time went on, and it caught the popular imagination, and it really kind of got the crowd, then it was more of a, oh well, no, I love it. oh yeah, I've seen it. It's great. And it's like, I think, you know, there's just an interesting parallel there.
Yeah, for sure.
So before we jump into spoilers, there are a couple other things we could talk about.
Maybe performances?
Yeah, the performances. The performances in this movie are fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of them.
Most of them.
No.
I don't know. There were some slow
I didn't like the
parts.
Little brother, I also.
Oh, the brother just made me so uncomfortable for no reason at all.
Okay. Perfect.
I've met that kid
so many times.
I haven't, and I just felt like, oh, he's channeling the Joker from Heath Ledger's performance. That's all
The way he talked, everything. Like, I've met that kid.
Really? Okay.
Plenty of times.
Yeah. He is in the new season of Twin Peaks. He's in the most recent episode for maybe 5 minutes, and he's pretty much the same.
I was going to say,
he's very similar.
I guess what I do like about him is that he's so, like, unlikable in the beginning. You're kind of questioning who he, like, if he's going to change at all during the movie or something.
Is he so unlikable that he will end up?
That's what I was predicting the whole time. I thought he was going to save somebody at the end of the movie, and it. Yeah, it's his character just.
He came on so strong that I had the same kind of like. Is he coming on so strong?
He's like a caricature almost.
That they're setting you up like, oh, he's definitely a villain. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Mm. So that when he, you know, switches sides at the, you know, like, you know, it just felt like he came on so strong.
I liked that though because it drew my attention away from the other members of the family.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And like, I thought the best performance was probably of the family was Allison. Allison Williams was just like unbelievable. Like the way she
Come on, man.
Spoilers. Something we can talk spoiler free about the soundtrack by Michael Abel.
I wanted to bring that up.
He's a first time composer as well.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it? You know what it is? Is that's probably a nom de guerre of Jordan Peele. He probably did this.
I will. You know, the first time talk has me thinking though that this is the first time in
history, first time for movies at least,
that black people have been able to actually make this many movies and have this much creative control over things. I'm serious. Think about like Barry Jenkins. We've got think about the amount of just anything that's
stuff coming out.
Ava DuVernay.
A lot. Yeah. For sure. It's this is what happens when you actually have real opportunity and access. And we'll start to see amazing products.
Well, you were talking about record-breaking stuff at the box office. I believe, and I think I saw this on either Jordan Peele's Twitter or maybe Ava DuVernay's Twitter, but it's the first film by a black filmmaker to gross over $100 million. But, I mean, she's making A Wrinkle in Time.
Right, which
that's definitely going to make... Yeah. I'll be shocked if that doesn't make over $100 million.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they were doing that. Tickets already sold. I didn't even know it.
But the Siki Liza
is that the main theme?
Kwa Wahenga song was
the main.
That was the first song that he wrote, and it's Swahili, and I guess roughly translates into
"Get out."
Brother, run. Listen to the elders. Run away. Listen to the truth. Save yourself.
Wow, ooh,
that's awesome.
Ooh, I got goosebumps.
But it's it's
listen to the elders.
Such a good. I guess when he was talking to Jordan Peele, he wanted an absence of hope, even though it has gospel influences, and gospel music's very like cheery music. Mm-hmm. And I think, with the chanting in that song, but it's not. There's you do hear that sort of absence of hope and kind of dread, and it's just really off-putting. And
I guess he didn't want to have like the classic like blues, like, music or anything like that, which I thought was really strong. Like it's so unrecognizable.
Mm-hmm.
What about Redbone, Childish Gambino? That's one that it starts out with. Mm-hmm. Stay woke, like is like in the chorus.
Did you hear the story of how he got that song on there? He played it for him and. He loved it so much that he let him keep it in the final cut or whatever.
Nice. I mean, it's such a perfect song. And, like, I didn't even realize. I didn't know it was Childish Gambino. At first. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. And
that's in the car during the
The isn't cold it open? During the very first scene, like when
the guy's walking.
He's
up
like showering.
I thought it was it.
Is it like, and like, it's like the very first scene. He's getting out of the shower.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's at like the factory or something.
Yeah, he's shaving and she's at
the factory. I mean, I thought it was a throwback song at first.
I didn't realize that either. Like, I did too.
I'm like, oh, wow.
Apparently he is retiring.
Yeah, he's retiring him. And everybody thought it was autotune. No, that's his real, like, that's just him singing.
Yeah.
He performed it live. And was that Jimmy Fallon?
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, I think I saw that performance. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Donald Glover.
Dude, he's amazing. I really, one of these days we got to talk Atlanta on the show.
Speaking of Atlanta, one of the other performances in this movie, Keith Stanfield, credited in this movie as Le Keith Stanfield, which is his full first name. But this guy,
wow,
we'll talk about him in spoilers, but
it's got the chops.
He can act. Has anyone seen Short Term 12? Because that was the first thing I saw him in. He's a scene stealer.
So you have seen him later, right?
Yeah, I've seen him.
Can I measure your tree?
He's my favorite part of Atlanta too, to be honest.
Not right now. Nigerian.
one more performance though that I want to talk about. It's an actress named Betty Gabriel who plays Georgina. We'll get into it more in spoilers, but
straight out of the 60s.
She is, I mean, people have been talking about how the movie came out early in the year. And it probably won't, even though it made a bunch of money. It's a horror movie. It came out in like February or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it probably won't get award season attention, but they might throw it a original screenplay bone.
If it
doesn't get something like that.
Yeah.
I
think it'll get an original screenplay. I think she should get a best supporting actress. If my vote counted. So, I mean, granted, it's still June. Who knows what's to come, but she should be up there, I think, so far at least, for consideration of best supporting actress.
You know our votes are going to get suppressed by the Republican machine.
They're going to gerrymander our Oscar votes.
I mean, I think I think it's almost too much of a splash to not get an Oscar.
Yeah, I think it'll have to get something.
It's got a... That would be...
But she's... A farce. I can guarantee you she's not going to get anything, and she really should, because she's... quite good in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just so... like, stripping away, like, anything besides just the technical, like, how it comes together. It's so strong just as a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just... everything is just functioning at such a high level that I can't imagine it not...
getting something.
Well, that's kind of where I'm at. I think it'd be, like, too obvious of a...
What was the last horror movie to really get a lot of Oscar buzz?
Did The Witch get any?
I don't even think so.
I don't think The Witch got anything.
Did this is a complete shot in the dark. Did 28 Days Later get anything?
No.
Aim Cinematography?
I don't think so. Probably Silence of the Lambs, to be honest.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I'll look into it. Do you guys want to jump into spoilers? Because there's a lot more that we can say.
Yeah,
we're just gonna.
Do you want a break or?
No. Let's just jump into it.
We've got some appropriate music to edit in there with movie magic.
Spoilers.
So spoiler talk, you guys.
Yeah.
Some stuff happens in this movie.
Oh, a couple of things.
Two things happen in this movie.
I really like how they portrayed the sunken place.
Yes.
Wow. Which I don't know if that's a I don't know where how to jump into the spoiler part of the thing, but
we'll assume that you've seen the movie.
Yeah, we'll assume that everyone's seen the movie. Yeah, so yeah, hypnotism is a big part of.
I think the sunken place. The way I saw it was that I think it looks different to each person, and I think that it looks like that to Chris because that's when he's powerless.
In front of the TV.
Right, he's in front of this TV. Which, I mean, it was a great visual effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was amazing. Yeah. Yet, I just think it's probably... Yeah. That's because that's where he was powerless. So it looks like that to him.
And to add credence to your point, one of the questions she does ask him is, like, when...
What were you doing?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's your most painful memory or something like that? And,
It was very reminiscent. And I think that it may have been too recent a film for it to have... influenced them because it probably came out while they were making this, but Get Out has a very similar visual motif in The Sunken Place to something that happens in Under the Skin.
Hmm. Yeah, it does.
The all black, mm-hmm.
All backdrop. Black, kind of floating in nothingness. Yeah. And both are very, very effective.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big questions was, what happens to Andre? That was one of the big questions in my feed right after they came out.
Andre, as we said, played by Keith Stanfield.
I think he's. I'm sorry, Andre.
Yeah. I think he's dead. Like, I think they probably kill him.
I think he's in there, but either.
You mean you think they killed his body?
Because without the armitages, like, how are they gonna stuff people back into the sunken place if something happens?
He's done.
So I think I kind of assume that. They would think, well, now any of these guys are potentially dangerous, so mm-hmm. they probably just kill all of them.
Oh, you think that's what happened?
I mean,
yeah.
Because how else would you, if something goes wrong like it did at the party? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just takes one flash of light, which
So let's talk about. Can we talk about that?
He's a
photographer. He's a photographer. Oh yeah, that too, right?
Yeah.
He's a photographer, so he's seeing the world for what it is, mm-hmm. and we're seeing it through his eyes in the course of the film. And the thing that's rescuing him at the end of the film is
photography
is mm-hmm. is seeing things and also earlier taking note of when something is just too bizarre to not draw attention to. So he tries to be slick and sneak a picture, mm-hmm. and that sets off what saves him later. I mean, I thought that was just cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I guess that could be an explanation as to what ends up happening to them, regardless of what actually happens to Andre. And, I mean, we saw lots of pictures of people.
I didn't notice any, yeah.
A lot of people that we saw pictures of, we didn't see in the movie, which means they're out there elsewhere.
Yeah,
in,
probably,
you know, suburbia.
Sold off in auction.
Mm-hmm.
Which I love how they did the, you know,
one
of my friends is like, well, why do you think it was that kind of an auction? Because it's silent. They can't do it in public
the game
anymore.
It's like a
symbolic thing. They have to do this silent bingo auction because they can't do this public.
Mm. I did think having his picture next to him was so strange.
Yeah. And having that reveal was like really awesome. It's just slowly pulling out and you see Chris.
Yeah,
it's like,
but it's
oh,
like,
no, you instantly
he's
realize.
Been walking around the party the whole time. He's clearly the reason you guys were all there. Why do you need a printed out portrait of him like up there with them, but
and I love
it adds to the
having
the fact
him,
that he's an object to them.
Yeah, exactly.
I love having him at the party where they're kind of showing him off like a show horse or something mm-hmm. like that. Like all these people are touring him
because black is in style right now.
Yeah, and those people, like the way the people talk to him before you're even like fully aware of what's going on, you may have like your suspicions as to what's happening.
Well, for sure.
you know that something's up, but you may not have figured out exactly where it's going, but you know that something's awry. But just the way that people talk to him is so like,
yeah.
Ugh.
And then I like how Walter, basically the hidden grandpa,
mm-hmm.
which is like another horror trope, the hidden grandpa in like a scary family, and it's like he's really hitting this song. And like when they all show up, he's out there like greeting people, he's shaking their hands, like it's just this interesting
clue.
He's like hugging people.
Mm-hmm. This
movie is definitely one that benefits from watching it immediately after finishing it.
Yeah, I wish I would have had a chance to do that.
So a little bit more on the, so when I first saw the auction scene, at first I kind of was turned off by it because I like it when in these slow burn thrillers that we're just in our protagonist's head and he hadn't seen that. So it kind of took me, when I first saw that, it kind of upset me. But then the degree of commentary that you get from that scene is worth it. I think it justifies it.
Like maybe it would have been better if we saw him seeing that, but maybe not seeing what the picture
like when
is.
When they're explaining what the coagula is to have, to have that extended flashback then.
Yeah.
I like the fact that there were bingo cards that they were using because of how to them this is just an auction, this is just a game, even though we're talking about
murder. Essentially. Murder/ enslavement.
Yeah, basically enslavement because they're still in there. Mm-hmm. What about Stephen Root?
What I thought was interesting.
Jim Hudson. The blind art dealer.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I got excited about that guy in particular because he Well, two things in particular. The other thing that I this is just a really good scene. One of the things I loved about it was not only is it in silence, and I didn't think of it from that angle that they have to be silent. The part that I kind of liked, that the way I took that was that we have it's being led by this guy who's going on about, oh, I'm super liberal, super liberal. And yet what he's saying does not matter because his actions, as he points and gestures to where the bit is at, that's really what's going on. Not what he's saying, what he's doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point of symbolism too. Yeah. And I thought, I love Jim Hudson's character because, I mean, what's more indicative of white privilege than a blind art dealer?
That's so great.
I'm serious. Like, that was such a great character. This guy has his assistant describe the art to him. I'm like, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm. What I liked about that Stephen Root character is that he even later in the film, we see when he's talking with Chris, he makes the comment about, Chris asks him, why black people? He's, you know, we've seen that everyone else is like interested in, you know, the black form and they're objectifying, like the one, I think the brother says something about how, like, with your build, you could be like a MMA artist.
Which
MMA,
I gotta get back to that later. Yeah.
And then they're talking about the old guy who wants to be a golfer, or who used to be a golfer, would like to be a young golfer. And
let me see your swing.
And he idolized Tiger Woods. He wants.
I know Tiger Woods.
He's sizing him up.
The woman is asking about what it's like to have sex with a black person. Stephen Root's character basically says, I don't care about that. All I want is your eyes. So what it's to me, what it's doing is it's trying to make it sound like he's not racist. I don't see race.
Yeah,
like people
see race.
Like people say, and literally a blind guy saying, "Oh, I'm not racist. I don't see race." And yet he's usually using this position of, you know, extreme privilege to subjugate a black person.
And I think another point of that is there's a lot of people who might say they have that kind of mindset, like, well, I don't care that it's a black person, yet they're still, that's the race that's usually in a position to subjugate, to exploit, to take advantage of. So it's like, it's still messed up. I don't want to curse.
Saved it though. That was
Were any of you guys really surprised with the keys reveal on the stairs with Allison?
No.
Allison, what's her name's character?
The way they'd set up the movie, to me, it really could have gone either way.
Because I can't imagine anyone being really shocked that she's in on it. But
I wasn't shocked. But I was. The way I thought of it is, it's either one of two things: A, she's in on it with them, in which case that all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But B, I also entertain the idea that they are exploiting her and maybe also hypnotizing her so that she doesn't realize. Like, when they find all the pictures, to me, that could have also been not her keepsakes, but the family's keepsakes. They're keeping it in her room for whatever reason.
Yeah,
but
in some weird door.
She also could have been a victim. I think the way it plays out is certainly more narratively sensical. it makes more sense that she is also in on it.
Sure.
And I love how she changes from this affected, frumpled kind of, you know, she's clumsy, not really clumsy, just kind of like absent-minded person to this like very neat, like she's all her clothes are in order. Yeah. She's like, her room's perfect.
She eats Fruit Loops one at a time.
Yeah. You know, there's a recurring theme about sugar throughout the entire film. Like, they're all like, and this is something that way back during like the slavery era, there were articles written about how Americans and like Westerners were becoming addicted to sugar and how it was like driving all this imperialism. And it's like this recurring theme, because even like in the very first scene when he's taking a shower and then it cuts to her at the bakery, that's the only time you see the same look on her face that she has later in the film, and she's looking at all this like the bakery goods and stuff. And then, of course, the cup.
The cup.
Stirring
yeah.
And,
yeah.
who wants dessert? Was that, who wants ice cream? Was that it?
I can't remember.
When he's like trying to get everybody to calm down after
the grandma holding the cake.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! This deserves a rewatch.
The dolly zoom that they do when it shows her eating in her bed, and I think I can't remember if she's eating or if she's on her computer, but basically it's showing her. And they're doing the dolly zoom, which is always like a little bit disorienting. It's like the thing from Vertigo.
Oh yeah, the Vertigo effect where they
zoom in while you pull back.
You pull out and zoom in, or vice versa.
Background distorting and the foreground is the same.
Never before has it made me feel so nauseated as it did in this. I actually started to feel ill with that dolly zoom, which I don't know if he meant to make me not feel well, but it's definitely done to disorient you.
And there was a classic,
and it was very disorienting.
Oldie song playing in the background, right? Or some popular chip, like really happy song.
Mm-hmm. But one thing I really like about the performances in this movie, and I think the three main ones are the Georgina character, Lakeith Stanfield is Andre, and Allison Williams, is the way the characters kind of turn on a dime, where. Mm-hmm. Everyone else, like, you kind of see where their character is going, and even if they may change a little bit, like, Chris certainly has a character arc, but when he turns, it's a little bit gradual, and you see kind of how he builds to that, whereas Andre, or Keith Stanfield's character, goes from, like, what is clearly, or maybe not clearly, but we know after seeing the movie, probably a 60-year-old nerdy white man in the body of a black guy, and then he turns in a flash, literally, to a young black guy who's freaking out and panicking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing. They did such a great job portraying these like people inhabiting their bodies, like Walter. Mm-hmm. The guy, I can't think of the actor's name. The guy who plays Walter is just incredible at that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And Georgina, too.
Yeah.
Just
the tension in her face when she's, no. Yeah. Oh, my God.
What a scene.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And then Allison Williams going from... You buy her as being panicked, or at least I did, as being panicked when he wants to leave. She's like, okay, like I'm ready to go.
Part of it, even though I already by then figured she was in on it.
Yeah. But as an actress, like, what isn't there like a little hint, because she's playing it so well, you weren't ever like...
Yeah, you're never 100% sure.
Yeah.
She really does a great job.
Yeah, I thought she did a fantastic job. And then, obviously, Daniel Kaluuya is Chris. That guy, I've only seen him in the three things that that episode of Black Mirror, and a far too small part in Sicario, I think, but dude can act.
Mm. The dude can make his eyes water real good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Georgina and him.
Yeah. What'd you guys think about Rod? The character that is basically the audience.
The audience surrogate slash...
It's really cool because it was like just almost too much comic relief.
Yeah.
Almost. Yet it was perfect because the moments where he showed up, like the movie was getting so tense at those moments. And then I just loved the whole, like, he never stops looking for him. Like, I don't know how, like... I was talking to my friends about that. Just like that's a big thing in the black community. Like that he just has this like steadfast friend that doesn't give up on him.
Yeah.
And I mean the real horror of the movie to me is that black people make up 13% of the population, yet we're 34% of missing people. So like that whole like thing of him going to the police and not caring, like him having to basically do it himself is just like really cool. Mm. And I've used his meme. His picture to respond to multiple people on Facebook who are just saying the most internalized racist stuff. So I just put a picture of Rob.
One last thing, and then we'll get into our lists of scenes and tropes, but the ending.
Brilliant.
Did you guys see the alternate ending at all or know anything about
ending?
Yeah. What's the alternate ending?
Just that it's not Rod who comes and gets him, it's the
police. He shows up and gets arrested, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was, but
he's like kind of oddly comforted by being arrested.
Cause it's better than,
Jordan Peele was actually talking about over the ending that I saw, but, basically saying that he was happy to have kind of conquered his demon with, Georgina after the car accident, and was... I don't remember the reason. I think the reasoning for why he changed the ending was because of the election or something.
He said it was because after 2014 and after the election, that the whole issue of racism has become such a like a revived topic that people, he felt America was more, in his words, woke.
Yeah.
So that he didn't feel the need to hammer home just how messed up things were, because people were already thinking about it.
It's also,
and then personally, I think the, like, that was such a powerful ending for black audiences. Like, the one that we got was huge. I mean, it's
that's him, him raising his hands.
Yeah.
Is, and then just, is a perfect, you know, culturally, definitely of this time,
chilling
moment.
Yeah, and we needed, chilling. We wanted a happy ending, and we got one.
I was gonna,
which I thought was just,
that's what I was gonna say. The other thing that's interesting about this is, as brutal as things that happen in the last 15, 20 minutes of this movie are, it's a happy ending, and it's a happier ending than a lot of what's happening in real life right now.
And, yeah,
and that's what was so, to me, so chilling about that ending is that you can't say it's just a movie, right? Mm-hmm. You can't say
the movie's better than, you know, what people get.
And I like how, you know, the, and this is what I was saying, like, about it being like liberal racism. This is, I mean, the whole thing about racism now is it's become institutionalized, scientific, and it's become routine, and it's become by the numbers, which is exactly what the Armitages do for slavery. At the end of the day, this is a movie about slavery.
Mm.
And I think, I mean, it's got all the tropes of a slavery movie. It's got, I mean, there's not an actual whipping in it, yet the brother constantly is trying to whip Chris with something.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Always has something in his hand. The cotton scene is there.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say.
Like, yeah.
Cotton,
so
cotton saves him instead of, you know, oppresses him.
And it's like, at the end of the day, that's what it's about. And at the end of the day, that's the big elephant in the room to now.
And the other thing that kind of goes along with that is, he doesn't focus on it for very long, but it's made clear that the house gets set on fire at the end.
Yeah.
Which means that the house gets set on fire, Warren shoots his own head off, and Georgina gets in a car accident and is mangled enough that I think that the family may end up getting away with no one ever knowing what they did. If the house hadn't burned down, you go and you see Stephen Root and he's had a, you know, part of his brain removed, and you find the videotapes of the whatever people explaining everything, or the grandpa explaining, here's what the coagula is and everything. The house burned down. All the evidence is gone except for the people who are out there, like Andre and then the other people. But the people who Chris had a more intimate affiliation with, you know, one shot their own head and the other one was, you know, possibly traumatically injured enough that nobody would even think twice to investigate, you know, if she's had brain surgery before. So, like slavery, the white people got away with it.
Yeah, it's pushed under the rug. It's constantly... I'm going to attempt to hide it.
All right. You guys want to jump in? Do we want to do...
scenes?
And then, scenes?
Tropes and then scene? I think it's two tropes, then one scene.
Let's do a trope, a scene, and then a trope.
Okay.
Kyle?
We kind of talked about it already a bit. The trope fridge horror, which is just a... I think it's mostly with the ending of the movie, you're just... at the end, or after you're done watching a movie, it becoming scarier after the fact, or becoming more terrifying after the fact. So this is when you finish the movie and then you think about what happened to Andre, or what, where all the people from the get together, like what they're doing, and just stuff. I think that's really my favorite part about modern day horror movies, is what happens to the people after the movie ends. Cause a lot of these new ones, they leave you thinking because something is left open. So, yeah, just not knowing exactly what has happened to Andre is kind of like chilling to me. And I love this trope. And it's probably going to be one that I'm going to look up a lot more of to see other examples of it, because I think it's a really interesting trope that not everyone can do well. But it's, I think it's called Fridge. Leftover, or what did I say?
Fridge horror is what
fridge,
you said.
Yeah, fridge horror. So, yeah, Thema, what would be your first trope?
I'm going to go with Death by Irony.
Oh, you...
That was my second one, too.
I love the fact that he goes on about how much he hates deer in this kind of awkward spiel.
It's a weird, like, it's a weird conversation.
Did I step on yours, too?
On everybody. Yeah.
Did everyone pick that one?
Yeah.
Because it's such a good
scene. I have it for a different reason, though.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's going on about this, and it's just a really uncomfortable, like, this guy's, it was just a weird conversation. And then later it's a deer that impales him. And then this is a kind of a recurrent thing, and the symbolism with the deer, but I won't get into that because, yeah. But I will say that this is the second movie that we've discussed on this podcast where there's Death by Irony with the same actor. The first one being Cabin in the Woods, where he just wants that merman so bad. And
Bradley Whitford really needs to be in all comedy horrors.
Oh my god,
yeah. He's really good at it. Mm-hmm.
He's so...
Yeah. I think it's funny how when he breaks out, the first thing he thinks about grabbing is the deer head off the wall to use it as a weapon, like out of everything in the room. Cause
out of everything,
I guess the bocce ball set doesn't have a mallet, does it? Bocce ball is just balls. That's what
you're thinking of, croquet.
Yeah. Another like super white pastime.
Oh my god! Like the game room is the creepiest thing.
So good, right?
I mean,
I was fully expecting. So there's a scene where during the Coagula explanation, it's like I forget if it's who it is, either on the TV or he looks up. Somebody looks up. I was fully expecting like a Lovecraftian bug to be up there. I was so freaked out. I don't know why. Yeah.
I'm gonna go with Chekhov's skill. There's this great moment where Jeremy is talking about MMA versus, you know, whatever else, jiu-jitsu basically versus other martial arts, and he's talking about how they're all about, you know, he's basically, he does this thing that they, it's from modern sports commentary. He's like, oh, you'd be a beast if you did that. Oh man, you've got the frame, you've got, you know, all these, basically all these physical advantages of the black athlete that you always hear like on ESPN, where the black athletes are beasts. They're, you know, they're, oh, he's so physically talented, whereas white athletes are hard workers. That if the, you know, if you would just stop pussyfooting around, he says, and like actually take training seriously. I mean, this is stuff that if you go on the UFC right now and like watch any UFC commentary, you'll hear the same kinds of things. Yeah. They're not as bad as they were now, I think, because they've started to notice it a bit. And then later, that skill is, it's subverted because Chris outsmarts him as he's trying to choke him, and he like uses the doorknob. So yeah, Chekhov's skill. And Chris, he played judo, so he's probably, he knows how to handle being choked a little bit.
So Death by Irony was stolen from me. I'm gonna go with a sub in. This is Sore Loser. This is describing the grandpa who's a sore loser who basically lost to Jesse Owens in the Olympics, and basically that's what,
which basically spawned the entire thing.
That spawned this whole thing of him wanting to oppress
Did
black
you
people.
Realize,
yeah, him wanting to oppress black people, but also wanting to be black people.
Also, that running.
That's
in the
why he's
of the
running.
Because I totally it didn't register because I didn't think back on his scenes from that different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand why he was running in the night.
Yeah.
And
in that same scene, Georgina is like admiring her new body. It seems like in the mirror, and it's like, maybe she just got her surgery done or something. And
who knows how long. Although, it to me, was implied that they said that they'd been dating about 5 months. And then later in the movie, they say that Andre had been missing for 6 months. And when he's on the phone in the beginning of the movie, he's talking to a girl. He calls her Babe, I think, on the phone. So I think that it was pretty much the same thing. She had been dating Andre for a little bit, lured him out. That's
it actually
said, it anyway.
There's a scene, Stephen Root talks about that, though, where he says that Jeremy's methods are more brutal than right. Rose.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, but you may be right.
I wonder, too, how did they somehow lured him in?
Was Andre
supposed to be like a party?
In the pictures, she may have in the pictures with her in the thing? It wasn't her catch. It was Jeremy's get.
She can also be dating more than one person at a time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's any good, solid answer. I don't remember if there's a picture of him or not. I don't think there is, actually.
I don't remember.
But either way, the sore loser trope. The other thing that the whole kind of like overtly racist father figure from like the 20s and 30s, but the son has done much more of the over, like the Bradley Whitford, the son has done more of the overtly evil things, and then he has these like corrupt evil children. It really reminds me of the Trump family.
Yeah,
you have Fred Trump, who got arrested with the KKK at a Klan rally in the 1920s. You
a
have
Klan riot where they started a riot.
Oh, right. Yeah. Even better. You have Donald Trump, who's doing the surgeries themselves. Then he's got these evil minion children. It wasn't obviously, it was made before all that. Or written and shot before all that, but
Eric is outwardly grotesque, where Ivanka is more pretty to look at.
Yeah, she's very good looking, but also just evil and dead inside. I think you can retrofit all these metaphors, and it works perfectly to me.
Wow,
Kyle, what's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene. I forgot we were doing this first. I really liked the scene where Chris is. Character really conquers his demons, and he has a clean getaway with the car, and he hits Georgina with it after she jumps out in front of him, and he could have gotten away, but really like has this sort of inner dilemma of whether he should go back for her, and because he knows that there's a real person in there, but and is picturing his mom again. And I don't know. I feel like half the people are yelling for him to get back in the car and drive away, and then half are like, "Dude, you need to like save her." Because I mean, nobody really knows how their surgeries work and if maybe she's curable or whatever. But yeah, just him going back and saving her, and then her freaking out on him, and then that ending with Rose, her name's Rose, her character
I think so,
coming after him with the gun.
Yeah.
And then yeah, that the whole like ending of just that build up of him having to decide to go back, I thought was really intense to me for some reason. But I think that was my favorite scene, if Nick has anything to say. He's gonna sit down and say no.
Nope.
Okay, awesome.
Is there, sir, I think you would know best, is there any historical significance to either A, the gun itself, or B, her kind of coming after him?
She's the White Hunter.
Nice. And she's literally
she's
wearing
the Great White Hunter. She's got this hunting rifle. She's got the whole white outfit, like in Jumanji.
Because I don't know anything about guns. Is there anything?
See, I took it like a prison. Like
that's another kind of scoped rifle, like they use that.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the gun from Schindler's List, like the big bolt action. Was it like a bolt action?
Yeah, it was a bolt action. Yeah. And she's the Great White Hunter because she's the best hunter in the family. She gets the most people.
Mm. Oh wow! Yeah,
but yeah, that was like the first shot that hit the tree, like right by him. I was like, oh my gosh! Like she's really gonna hunt him down. Mm. It's messed up. And then she sends. That was the part that I didn't really like when she's like, Grandpa. And then, like, she, like, yeah, summons Grandpa, say, like,
to him, get him Grandpa or something.
I think that was exposition. Yeah. That's how it functioned mostly for me, is and, so we know.
And then she's, like, Grandma, like, when she gets in the car, and that was kind of weird. But, yeah, that whole scene was, I really liked it a lot. Thema, would be your favorite scene?
Honestly, the ending was going to be my number one, and I even had the backup as the bingo scene, which is why I talked a lot about both of them already. I think I've said what I had to say. But
with the bingo scene, is it that they bid on them, or are they winning it? Like, they're not actually playing bingo.
No, but if you look at their cards, each one of them is a winning card. So it's like, by virtue of happenstance, randomness, they happen to be, the social analogy here would be they happen to be born white. They could have been born anything, and now they're using that privilege that they got randomly to pray.
Life. Yeah.
That's kind of how I took it. I don't know if that analogy holds up.
I'll buy it.
You'll buy it.
So speaking of buying things, there's a strong significance around the word buck. And we buy things with bucks. They're our main form of currency, just like they were during slavery when one black person was, that was our entire economy. Our whole financial system, everything is built around slavery and the sale of black men and women, black men who were known as bucks, which that's why the scene where he kills him with the deer head is my favorite scene in the film, because not only, I mean, the whole thing about the deer, him hitting the deer at the beginning of the movie, or Rose hitting the deer, and the dad talking about black people as deer is the metaphor when he's talking about how they're taking over, about how, you know, all this stuff. And he wishes, oh man, she could, he's like, so that wish there was more of him, you could kill her. Whatever. Mm-hmm. And so when he like kills him with that, it's this huge, I mean, it's such a huge moment, like to me in black cinematic history, where we had these characters of the buck, the mammy, the, you know, there's other just tropes around that. And for him to actually kill him with a deer's head, to me was perfect. Mm-hmm. And so, I like that the brutality in the film is visited upon them by Chris. It's not, I mean, that's when things get really violent.
Where he goes full Django.
Yeah. Right. That's the only time the movie actually gets like really, really violent.
Yeah.
And it starts out with, wow, what a great horror kill also. It just, I thought like
that's a good point too.
The symbolism to it, I just thought was so perfect. And just like, I mean, he's this buck that they're all examining, and, you know, kind of hoping to be. So that was my favorite scene.
I was going to go with the no scene of Georgina, which is
powerful.
It's so, like, her performance in that, it's breathtaking. Yeah. She's unbelievable. But so we talked about it already. So what I'm actually going to go with is one thing that while you're watching it, it leaves you thinking one kind of perception of these characters and their dynamic. Then you go back knowing everything that you know, and it plays a little differently. And that's when they get pulled over, or not when they get pulled over, but when the cop comes and he asks to see Chris's license. And it sets up a couple things. It sets up that this is the world we live in, where he clearly didn't do anything. He has no reason to see his license. It shows who Chris is, because he's like, you know what? Like, it's fine. It's not going to hurt me to show my license. I'm just going to do it. He kind of understands how the world is, it seems, better than Rose does. And Rose, upon first viewing, it was a little like, what she's doing is she thinks she's being noble by protecting him and maybe exploiting her own position of privilege a little bit.
100%.
On his behalf. But at the same time, he's also like telling her, no, it's fine. And she's ignoring his own wishes a little bit. So what she's doing is maybe noble, but maybe going a step too far, perhaps, I guess, depending on how you look at it. And then she says, like, nobody messes with my man, which is like,
right, the ownership thing.
It's like when I'm first seeing it, before you know, because I knew nothing about this movie going into it, I see that and I was like, that's kind of hot. Like, she did maybe overstep her bounds a little bit, but that's kind of hot. But when you go back and think about that scene again, what she's doing is she's making it so the cop never sees his ID.
I was just going to say, yeah, that's part of it too.
Oh, I didn't think of it that way.
Right.
Which
that's another reason why the ending is so good, because it's one of the few times in horror movies where you're actually not happy that the cops are showing up in that particular situation. Like any other horror movie, you're like, oh, the cops are here, we're saved.
I've got a couple things about that. Well, for one,
totally, 100%.
For one, I'm never ever happy with a cop show up and at all. Yeah. And that scene really struck with me, because that's happened to me before, where I was basically pulled over. Well, we weren't pulled over. Yeah, cops. I was with a white girl. This is like early college age. And they're like, oh, give us your IDs. And I'm like, just reach for my ID. And this white woman I'm with is like, no, he did. Why do you have to do this? Da, da, da. She doesn't have to show you. And it was just like, I'm sitting there thinking, I want to get out of this. I want to go home. Like, right. Yeah. I don't want to be hurt. I don't want to get like in trouble. I don't want these guys to flip out. Like, so it's a very much a privileged like moment.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Kyle, what's your next trope?
Man, that really creeps me out about the her not letting the cops see us.
I didn't think of it that way, but it is really creepy.
Because she knows that he's not going to be... He's going to be...
My man. I didn't... For. Yeah, I didn't...
Yeah, I didn't even...
This needs a rewatch.
The my man in ownership didn't... It didn't register to me that way, because I only watched it once, but seeing it at the time, to me, it's just like...
My man.
My man.
Yeah. Yes. He's never said my man so many times. I didn't. So many things that are in there that, I mean, clearly, just need to look at it again.
Death by Irony was my other one, so I'll just choose two tropes that we've covered before with their own episodes that combine in one scene, and that's the oneer and music or soundtrack dissonance, and it's the opening sure. shot. I'm pretty sure it's a oneer.
I think it is a oneer.
It's shot much different than the rest of the movie, and I really like that. And then the Run Rabbits Run song in the background.
This weird, like...
That he's listening to is, like, one of the weirdest...
It's something from, 100 years ago.
Yeah. And he's wearing this...
I bet that was the grandpa.
You think it was? Well,
because of the old-timey music, and his speech pattern was very old-timey.
You don't think it was Is it Jeremy?
Yeah, it's Jeremy though who does it.
Oh, in the brutal way.
Because he tries to choke him out the same way.
Necessarily Jeremy alone. Like it could have been the grandpa driving. That's why the music was there. Because later we see Jeremy's stuff in the passenger seat.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we? I didn't realize that.
And it'd probably be a lot easier for him to jump out of a car, scoop somebody up if somebody else is driving. I think the outfit. Do you guys remember People Under the Stairs?
Yeah. I watched that based on your rec, actually.
That's another movie that touches on like race and just racial dynamics and horror. And that's the outfit. Like, it's similar to me to the outfit that the dad wears in that when he's hunting for the kid who escapes in the house. I can't remember
the little kid's name. That was a creepy movie.
What I wanted to say is I'm pretty sure it is a oneer, and it was very reminiscent of two horror movies. The wonder in the beginning of Halloween, but also more recently It Follows.
It Follows, the neighborhood sort of pan around.
Yeah. The other thing I like about that scene is just he knows that something is bad already from the start.
Well, he was the audience right there, where he's like, "F this, I'm turning around."
And I love that
they're not going to get me today or something.
And it's the whole that to me, that's the entire point of the movie is that it's finally a movie about what's really scary in America: white people. Like being somebody who's grown up in Ohio, where I don't know if you guys know this, in Columbus, like more black people, like we look at like just per capita, are shot by the police in Columbus than anywhere else in Ohio. Nation. Like we have the highest rate of killings than anywhere else in the nation.
I thought you were going to say in the rest of Ohio.
Columbus. And having grown up here and been in all different kinds of places, all over the counties, everywhere around here, like that is always scary. Like that was always scary. Going to neighborhoods and just being surrounded by all this like essentially privileged power and just knowing that I can get arrested, harmed. Nothing will stop them. Like it's always a scary situation. So I really loved that like like he's like, you know what? I'm getting the hell out of here. Like
Demo.
The cult. This part isn't it is. It also has social weight. But even if it didn't, I would still love it. I always love seeing this thing pop up in horror movies. In this case, it's like the Order of the Coagula, which is so creepy.
Right.
He missed the colors up there.
And how did we break down that name?
So I don't know, because coagula, it sounds like coagulant, which is like this clotting.
Yeah. Like something stopping bleeding.
Yeah. So stopping aging, maybe? Time bleeding? I don't know.
Maybe. I couldn't parse together exactly what that meant, if it meant anything. I mean, I assume that it does, but nothing, at least... There was nothing direct, metaphor-wise, that I could.
So their group was called the Coagula? I forget what, like, word Coagula... Or that was the process. Okay.
It's called the Coagula, which... Stopping death, you could say that. But even that, there is that... Yeah.
Do you notice the colors that they were wearing? I think they were all wearing red or some form of red. All the people, all the guests. And Lisa was saying she was doing some research after she watched the movie. She said that there's a scene where I think it's Rose and Chris. They're sitting down and he's wearing like stripes and someone else is wearing blue. And when they sit next to each other, they look like an American flag or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have to look it up because I think she, I forget who the two characters were, but. Yeah, the way they sat down, apparently it looks like an American flag, which is...
I don't know if we gave enough love to the cinematography in this movie, because it is... Some of the shots are just framed... It's just beautiful to look at, and terrifying, but beautiful and terrifying and beautiful and terrifying. Sir?
So the other trope I have is fate worse than death. I think that... I really like it because the whole movie is an analogy to slavery. And the whole idea of just having, you know, a person or a group of people have complete control over your body and you have nothing, like no way to really to do much about it. And I think there's this recurring thing in American thought that there are things worse than slavery. And like, there really isn't, especially the kind that we had here. Like, there's only, I think, three real slave societies that have ever existed on our planet. Rome, Brazil, during the slavery era, and then America during the time. And like the things that happened in the process and the total degradation of humans at that time, like nothing has been worse than that. And I think like the only people who think that anything was worse, I think just don't know enough about it yet. And it's like, there's very few, like we've talked about it before. Like, are we ever going to get a good slavery film? It would be so hard to film some of this stuff. I mean, the closest I think they've ever come to is Goodbye Uncle Tom.
Oh, the...
Adio Zio Tom from the 70s. It's probably the only thing I've ever seen that comes close to the kind of stuff that, like, you could read about that happened. And it's something that I'm hoping that will eventually, like, get laid to rest. Just this idea that there were worse things, or that it wasn't that bad, or that it was somehow like a civilizing, which is so racist, like civilizing effect, or there was anything positive about it, because it was completely horrible. And it's like, really, it plays out in the whole idea of things like the idea of a slave mistress. There was no slave mistress. There were enslaved, sex trafficked, raped women.
Right.
There was no, you know, the recent complete ridiculousness by Bill Maher. Calling himself, I won't say it here, a house Negro, basically, is, it's like, so that's him making light of this incredibly brutal situation that's happening to these people who are stuck in this home being, you know, ripped from their families, who are, I mean, I could go on about the stuff that actually happened there, yet it's, there's nothing that's remotely positive about it. And I think, so it's clearly a fate worse than death. And I think that this film really plays that perfectly when Walter shoots himself.
I was gonna say literally at the end.
Well, you knew that was gonna happen, because what else? He had no other escape. I mean,
yeah,
but that's less about the analogy, more about just the plot. But
and Bill Maher, if you're listening, I never liked you anyway.
I mean,
I thought you were gonna say, when you said Bill, actually, another, you know, racist TV pundit, Bill O'Reilly, who I think it was around this time last year, actually, said that the slaves who built the White House were
really well treated.
Yeah, they were treated pretty well.
In response to Michelle Obama.
Her DNC speech.
Pointing out the progress we have made.
Mm-hmm. And then Bill O'Reilly won, trying to disprove her.
Ah, back when he had his job.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly. Fellow podcaster now.
Wow.
Oh, God.
Yep. listeners,
I'd love to see the reviews he gets, like the five star.
I think it's a bunch of five star and a bunch of one stars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, listeners, don't listen to the Bill O'Reilly podcast. Listen to us. My number one is, I believe this trope is named after a Kendrick Lamar song, Poetic Justice. Mm. But it has to do with, that's a good song.
I don't know that one.
I don't think we have the rights to
After the,
Anyways, Rose's mom uses Chris's guilt of his own mom's death and her essentially dying alone after being hit by a car to her and the family's advantage. And the poetic justice at the end is, of course, that her daughter, who's the last one alive in the family, through all these things that the family's done, ends up dying alone on the side of the road. Not hit by a car, but alone and bloodied, dying on the side of the road.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Let me throw something out there.
Let's hit me with it. Mm-hmm.
So there is a possibility that we know that the daughter, not the daughter, not Rose, Rose's mom, mm-hmm. because she's a master hypnotist, that she's hypnotized her husband and her two kids to do the bidding. And I would throw this out there is I almost prefer that version of events in a bit, in a way. Because it's like the parent, the spouse, infecting other people, infecting those close to them with the same kind of vitriol.
You think? See, because I thought
it's better.
I thought it was...
Because it lets them off the hook.
Yeah.
Which and I do think, sure. though, I mean, I don't think, I definitely don't think Rose is hypnotized. You know, that's mm-hmm. like one of the theories. I think Jeremy and the dad are somewhat hypnotized. And this is something that a friend of mine brought up.
Okay.
Because she's like, well... There's just that trope of like the women being the brains behind the operation, the guys are the muscle. They do all the physical things. Uh-huh. Like the dad definitely admits to being hypnotized because of the cigarettes. And then if you notice, you remember when Jeremy is like getting really excited at the table,
and the mom tells him to stop.
The mom tells, yeah. And doesn't she like? I don't know if she.
Oh, if she does something, that'll be really interesting.
On the rewatch. Really watch it. Yet he's the only one that she that he like. She's the only one he listens to. Mm-hmm. So I thought
that's interesting.
I just think that for all of them to be, and like for Rose to be hypnotized, kind of just mm-hmm. and Rose it shoots a little bit of the
narratively evilness. Though, what goes against that is that it was his parents who, or his dad who, kind of like set this whole thing in motion.
Yeah, but I would say that I don't think though that her parents are part of it. I would say that she's inherited, you know, her
the in-laws. Is that what you're saying?
No. That she, wait. Is it supposed to be the wife's dad, or is it supposed to be?
I thought it was the wife's.
Dad. I thought it was the wife's parents.
Oh,
too.
Was it? I thought it was Bradley Whitford's dad. Maybe you guys are right. In which case,
it doesn't.
Does
he say like my daughter perfected it?
Oh,
does he? I can't.
I don't know.
I can't remember.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, if that's the case, then I definitely am. I buy much more into that theory. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that it was his dad because he was the one telling the story about the Olympics. And I thought he'd said my dad, but maybe not. In which
I don't know.
I don't know. I guess it's a moot point.
Yeah.
I do think, I mean, I just feel like it places too much of the whole thing on the mom.
Trying to scapegoat everything on
yeah,
her.
And then, and also, I mean, the one thing.
Their act.
I was going to say, the point of the movie is that.
That they're all
it's not
it.
One evil person.
The whole community of people.
Yeah.
Some people were like, well, you know, it kind of puts it all in the family. And I'm like, not really, because you've got a whole group of people who are benefiting from this.
The entire town or whoever, yeah.
Right. Or maybe even just that. You know, maybe it's not the entire town yet. It's still seemingly a lot of them. Yeah. Right.
Right.
It's like a lot of them.
The entire town that we're exposed to, that we're that we get to see.
Yeah. All right. So that was our review of Get Out. If you've seen the movie, you can hit us up at onthetropes@gmail.com. As always, I've been your host, Nick, and we have been
Sir
Demo
and Kyle.
And join us again next week when it'll still be Halloween in July and we'll be talking about zombies.
On the Tropes.